Thank you very much and good afternoon, everybody. Okay, so let's talk about why energy demand management is central to energy security. Energy security for me is personal as well as geopolitical. Paul, you talked about energy security and consumer security, and I tend to sort of think of them as one thing. As Jim, you've already mentioned, there are many, many households in the UK right now who are suffering from energy insecurity because they can't afford to pay for the energy services that they need to support their well-being. And that's here where I'll do my first go of taking a little bit of issue with what's already been said. They can't afford their energy services. It's not just about the price of energy, it's about how much it costs to keep warm. And there's more than just fuel that's involved in that. Anyway, we can come back to that later. So, what would a secure net zero energy system look like from your perspective as a household energy user? Let's take it right down to that level. You'd live in a home that is kept comfortably warm or cool throughout the year, but costs you very, very little to do that. Maybe you'd have a heat pump connected to a shared ground loop, and maybe some of your hot water would come from solar thermal panels that are on your roof. Or maybe you'd have your heat and hot water, and cooling even, supplied through a district heating network. You'd probably have a battery. You might even have some storage using phase change materials inside your own home. Your home would be incredibly well insulated and would maintain its temperature for several hours without any space conditioning running, heating or cooling. And because of all those things, your home would be very flexible as an energy user, and you'd be able to offer to the energy system flexibility services for which you would be paid. I could paint pictures like that for you as a user of transport, or you as somebody who works in an office or a lab. But let's just use that one example. I think it explains what I'm talking about. So we need to transform our system to an alternative that is based around homes like that, or a transport system or offices like that. So the question is, how do we do it? And the first point that I think we always need to bear in mind when we're thinking about the energy system is that the most secure, the most reliable, the most affordable form of energy is the energy we don't need to use. Outcomes from 5 years' worth of research at the Centre for Research into Energy Demand Solutions, CREDS, suggest that we can halve our energy use by 2050, whilst at the same time enhancing our quality of life. We'd reduce UK per capita energy use to around 40 gigajoules a year, which is actually quite a lot less than the current global average per capita annual energy use. There's a lot of potential in homes. We've just talked about how we can change homes. Transport energy use could be reduced by 60%. And in industry, we could reduce our industrial energy demand by about a quarter, looking at materials efficiency as well as energy efficiency. So there's a lot that we could do on the demand side. But demand management isn't just about using less. It's also about when we use energy. If we are going to transform to a primarily renewable electricity system, and at the same time, as has already been mentioned, electrify how we receive our heat, electrify how we travel around, that's an enormous amount of investment in our electricity system that we're talking about. In generation, but also in the transmission and distribution infrastructure that brings the electricity to us. And if we're going to ensure that we've got a reliable system without spending more than we need to and more than we can afford, we really do need to think about making a lot more use of flexibility in our demand. I'm sure most of you will have heard about National Grid's Demand Flexibility Service. It's in the news a bit at the moment again. And this is just a snapshot of a web page that shows how one energy supplier is trying to get its customers to engage with that system. Reducing peak load, which is what these kind of initiatives are all about, reduces the requirement both for generating capacity and also for transmission and distribution capacity, so it can reduce system costs. To give you just one example, UK Power Networks distribution system operator is planning over the next 5 years to 2028 to contract for enough flexibility to allow it to avoid £410 million worth of investment in its distribution network. That's just one distribution network operator. There are five or six of them around the country, and there's also obviously the transmission network. And that's before you even think about avoided investment in generation. So we can save a lot of money. But it's not just about saving money. You can see from this extract from UK Power Networks Forward Plan that they also see using more demand flexibility as a way to speed up connections to the grid. Now, this is important for two reasons. At the moment, the queue for connecting new renewable generation to the transmission and distribution grid can be as long as 10 years. You can wait as long as 10 years to connect some new generation equipment to the grid. And that's seen as one of the biggest blockers to transitioning away from imported fossil fuels faster than we're currently doing. It's one of the biggest blockers to meeting net zero faster than we're currently doing. But it's not only about generation equipment. There's been a report published in the last few days from IDRIC, the Industrial Demand Research Centre, saying that they've surveyed major industry across the country and connections queues on the electricity system are holding up electrification of industry. It's holding up the development of CCUS. It's holding up the development of hydrogen production. So unlocking that is crucial, and flexibility, demand flexibility, is a crucial bit of that. Okay, so it's important. Energy efficiency is important, energy flexibility is important. How do we make it possible? First of all, we've got to ensure that the new technologies that consumers are investing in are energy efficient and able to provide flexibility. It means we need heat pumps with the right controls, controls that enable them to be flexible. We need well-insulated buildings to use them in. And we need to figure out where we put energy storage in our homes. There's some easy wins, some really easy wins here. We should not be installing heat pumps that don't have controls that enable flexibility. We shouldn't be building new homes that aren't super efficient and enabled for flexibility. We are doing both those things at the moment, but it's quite simple to stop, I would suggest. Some things are a bit more tricky. How do you insulate older homes, for example? Or where do you put energy storage in a home that got rid of its hot water tank a heck of a long time ago? So there's some things we need to think about. And perhaps even more difficult than that, how do you ensure that people use the new technologies in the way they're intended to be used? Jill, you asked a question at the beginning. Do you know how efficient your heat pump is and do you know how to use it the most efficiently? Most people, the answer would be no. Heating your home, your well-insulated home with a heat pump is a completely different thing to heating your leaky home with a gas boiler. And we need to learn how to do that. And somebody needs to explain that to us. It doesn't tend to happen at the moment. Everything that I've talked about so far has been based on the use of new technologies, on more use of existing technologies. But that's only part of the story. There's a whole other aspect to energy demand management that's about changing the way we do things, changing either the quantity or the nature of our demand for energy services. What I'm talking about here is things like choosing to live in smaller homes and making more use of shared space and shared services. It's about choosing active travel rather than the car. So we're achieving the same things we want to achieve, but a little bit differently, which results in less energy use. If you take both of those together, choosing and using new technologies and the more fundamental changes to the way we do things, Climate Change Committee analysis suggests that between them, those two things will account for about 60% of the change that we need to get us to net zero. So that's quite a lot. Do we pay enough attention, therefore, to ensuring that people are willing to choose and use these new technologies, even when it seems to be a little bit tricky? Do we pay enough attention to making sure they understand how to use them? Do we think enough about how the energy system and the wider world in which it operates, because the energy system isn't the end of it, there's a bigger system that we need to think about as well. Do we think enough about how that enables the more radical shifts that we want to make? Clearly we don't, and clearly we need to, not only to deliver a net zero system, but also one that offers energy security to everybody. Of course, we're not completely ignoring people and demand in what we're doing. There are the commercial offerings from companies like Octopus. There's the regulation, which is pushing our distribution system operators to start contracting for flexibility. Those are just examples of the way we're already thinking about the demand side in our energy system. Also in academia. So the UK Energy Research Centre has an observatory that looks at how we engage people in energy and climate issues, looks for good practice and shares that knowledge. So we are thinking about it, but I think what we're not doing, we're not yet truly embedding energy users into the way we're designing the future energy system. It's more like a parallel effort. You've got a bunch of people doing engagement over here and you've got a bunch of people doing system design over here. And they talk to each other sometimes, but not really that much. I think one core reason for this parallel tracks and for the fact that we don't think about people enough is that when the engineers and scientists that design the hard infrastructure are doing that, they hardly ever talk to social sciences and humanities people, let alone collaborating with them. It's not that surprising because we talk different languages. I don't know which side of that particular fence any of you are on, but if you try to talk to people from the other side, it can really make your head hurt. But I promise you, I'm a natural scientist. I'm a chemist by background. I spend a lot of my time working in the social sciences now. And I promise you, if you're a natural scientist or an engineer, you can find sociologists and anthropologists who explain their ideas in ways that don't make your brain hurt. And when you do, it really is worth the effort. If we're going to deliver an optimal net zero energy system, not just a functional one, we all need to take the time to understand, to listen to talk to understand each other a bit better. And I think if we do this, we'll be much more likely to design a system that doesn't only deliver net zero, but also ensures that resilience, that affordability, that security, both for the UK PLC and also for every single household within it. So I guess my takeaway is keep your mind open. It works best that way. Thank you.